This is Audible.
Arshed Audio presents Scorpions, the battles and triumphs of FDR's great Supreme Court justices. Written by Noah Feldman, read by Cotter Smith. Chapter 23, The Saboteurs. Meanwhile, in the summer of 1942, the court for the first time became formally involved in the war. It started, improbably enough, in the Hamptons. On Saturday night, June 13th, a German submarine slipped past American defenses and dropped four German soldiers onto the beach at Amagansett, a quiet Long Island town. This New York landing was followed a few days later by another drop of four more soldiers at Ponte Vedra Beach, Florida. The eight Germans had all spent significant amounts of time in the United States before the war, and they spoke English. Several with perfect American accents. Two of them, Herbie Haupt and Ernst Peter Berger, were naturalized U.S. citizens. All had chosen to return to Germany to become part of the war effort. Handpicked by the Abwehr, German military intelligence, the men had been trained in explosives in a month-long course at Quenzi, a lake in Brandenburg, Prussia. Their instructions were to rendezvous in Cincinnati on July 4th to await further instructions. Their superiors had chosen a series of bridges and manufacturing plants for them to destroy. The infiltrators were carrying fuses and TNT. They had been instructed to wear their uniforms upon landing so that they would not be considered spies if caught. Fulfilling this directive, the men who landed in New York wore Navy uniforms while clambering onto shore. On the beach, under cover of darkness, they changed into civilian clothes, leaving the uniforms in a sea bag that they half-heartedly tried to bury in the sand. The Florida party was less precise. They wore bathing suits, but put on German Marine uniform caps while landing, within moments of making sure they threw away their hats. The would-be saboteurs in Florida landed and got away undetected. The Amagansett landing ran into trouble. On the beach around midnight, the Germans' leader, George John Dosch, bumped into a lone Coast Guard foot patrol, 21-year-old John Cullen, who until the year before had been a furniture delivery man for Macy's. Dosch told Cullen that he and his friends had gone night fishing from East Hampton, but that their boat had run aground. Another of the Germans approached, speaking a language Cullen did not understand but that he thought was German. Dosch told him in English to shut up and get back to the others. Then Dosch handed Cullen what he said was $300 and told him to forget what he had seen. Cullen ran through the night to the shingled Amagansett lifeboat station that functioned as the Coast Guard base. He woke the other Coast Guardsmen and told them there were Germans on the beach. His boss was incredulous until Cullen showed him the money. He broke out rifles and the team of eight headed down to the beach. By the time the Coast Guard team got there, the saboteurs were gone. After walking for several hours, the Germans made their way to the Amagansett train station. At 6:59 a.m., they were on the Long Island Railroad, headed for Queens. Having escaped detection, the saboteurs would have been in a position to do serious damage had they been so inclined. But Dosch, the leader of the New York group, had other plans. He told Berger that he had never planned to carry out his orders. Instead, he would turn himself into the FBI in the hopes of helping the U.S. war effort against Germany. Berger agreed to help. Dosch and Berger went to a phone booth in a hotel lobby on Madison Avenue, and Dosch called the New York branch office of the FBI. His call was routed to the Nutter's desk. Dosch told the field agent that he was a German who had arrived from Europe the previous day, and that he had important news for J. Edgar Hoover. When the agent gave his note of the call to his supervisor, the supervisor commented, "Napoleon called yesterday." No further action was taken. Dosch decided he would take a train to Washington, D.C., to see Hoover in person. First, he embarked on a marathon session of Pinochle, his favorite card game, that lasted 2 days and left Dosch up by several hundred dollars. Then he boarded the train. Once in D.C., Dosch checked into the expensive Mayflower Hotel, where, as he could not have known, J. Edgar Hoover lunched every day on fruit salad. After a good night's sleep, he called FBI headquarters from the phone in his room and asked for J. Edgar Hoover's office. After he had stated his business, his call was directed to two more offices, each of which transferred the call to another department. Finally, as he was about to hang up, Dosh reached an agent who had heard a report of possible infiltration on Long Island. The agent asked Dosh to come in and meet him. When Dosh arrived at headquarters and began to tell his story, the FBI sent agents to his hotel room where they found the $82,500 in cash that he had brought with him. That convinced them that he was a real saboteur and not a crank. On June 27th, the FBI announced it had arrested the eight men. For purposes of national security and self-aggrandizement, Hoover concealed the fact that Dosh had turned in himself and the others. The problem now was what to do with the infiltrators. Roosevelt, who had not been told how the Germans were caught, had no doubts on that score. The two Americans, he said, were guilty of high treason, just as guilty as it is possible to be. The other six, he noted, had landed in naval gear but had been arrested in civilian clothes. This, he said in a memo that he wrote himself, was parallel to the famous Revolutionary War cases of the British spy Major André and the American spy Nathan Hale. Both of them had been hanged. The infiltrators should be tried by court-martial and executed immediately. The only question, he said to an aide, was whether they should die on the gallows or by firing squad. Roosevelt's aim in demanding a fast execution was to send a signal both to Germany and the American public that the United States would not tolerate infiltration. The fact that it had been so easy to introduce saboteurs into the United States revealed a huge hole in American civil defense. A strong message was needed to counteract this gap, or at least direct attention away from it. Roosevelt had no intention of allowing the courts to stand in the way. "I want one thing clearly understood, Francis," he told his Attorney General, Francis Biddle. "I won't give them up. I won't hand them over to any United States marshal armed with a writ of habeas corpus. Understand?" Biddle understood. As he himself wrote, it was obvious that the reliance of the public on their government would be immeasurably strengthened if these would-be saboteurs were disposed of promptly. The difficulty was that despite Roosevelt's certainty, it remained unclear just what crime deserving the death penalty the men had committed, or what sort of court should put them on trial. The infiltrators had not blown anything up, nor taken any steps after landing that indicated they might. Biddle put the problem succinctly. "If a man buys a pistol, intending murder, that is not an attempt at murder." The scion of an old Philadelphia family and a graduate of Groton and Harvard like Roosevelt, Biddle was a liberal, and by the standard of government service, a sensitive person. Roosevelt enjoyed teasing him. On one occasion, while the president was preparing his state